Hi, and welcome to a special edition of GFW Radio. You're getting two this week, if everything goes well. This is Jeff Green, the editor-in-chief of Games for Windows Magazine, and we are here with a very special guest today. We have Chevat Yearly, the CEO of Crytek, here to talk to us about his upcoming game. What the heck is it called?
I know what it's called.
It's Crysis. Yes. So, hi.
Hi there.
Also on board are Darren Gladstone, Sean Elliott, and Sean Malloy. So, how long have you been over here in the U.S.?
Actually, I just arrived yesterday morning. And some people, there's a myth that I was here for the last 2 weeks because I showed up 2 weeks ago. But no, I was in the office cranking on the bugs, making sure the Crysis ships. And yeah. So I just flew in yesterday morning.
And we'll try not to ask too hard questions if you're tired.
No, I'm still like in a jet lag. I'm about to go to bed now.
You're not going to go back to your room and play Halo 3?
No, unfortunately not. Or maybe fortunately not. I don't know.
Oh. So right before we turned on the machine here, I was informed that it was a little bit deliberate that the Crysis beta started at about the same time as the Halo 3 launch?
Yes, because it wasn't deliberate per se in terms of to confront, but the date was picked deliberately because we said we have to make sure that Crysis gets its beta time. And it coincided that it was same time with Halo 3, but we said we should not move out because of Halo 3. Mm-hmm. So deliberate decision was not to move out because of Halo 3, but we didn't care for any other releases because it's not PC platform. Mm-hmm. And so the gamer profiles are different, and I guess we should talk about that maybe a little bit more.
So you weren't scared of Halo 3 then?
No, we weren't, because it's a 360. It's a game which people wait for 360, and Crysis is a game for PC, clearly. Mm-hmm. So,
and it clearly has enough of its own hype, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we're happy with the amount of hype we have, so we don't need more hype built through Halo 3.
Uh-huh. I guess we could just kill this podcast then if it doesn't need more hype.
Well, I'm not here to build hype, I guess. I'm here to entertain you three.
That's right. We invited you. That's right.
Part of the difference that you're saying, I mean, clearly they're different audiences. There's going to be some overlap in the same way that all of us here will eventually play Halo 3. Some of us have already been playing it as of last night. But I wanted to know a little bit more about who you specifically see as, you know, outside of the vagaries of everybody as being your potential audience, but who do you really see as your audience? And to tie that into two other questions that I see or comments that are most frequently made about the game, some of them we talked about before. One is that, for example, someone's on a message board and they post a screen. Here's a new video of Crysis. Here's a new screenshot. Everyone goes, oh, my God, that looks great. Then the next comments, and they're always in the next post, you can guarantee it, is too bad my computer won't run that. And then, too bad it just looks good and there's no game there. So yeah, you can hit those in either order, but I think the too bad my computer won't run that ties in pretty clearly with the notion of audience and who the game's for.
Yeah, it's like when I see the new Lamborghini picture recently and by the international, the IAA, I said, too bad I don't have the money to buy the car. It looks great, you know? Mm-hmm. So the point here is Crysis is a hardcore game, like targeted primarily for hardcore. But of course it scales back. So if you don't have the money or the pockets effectively to have the equipment to play Crysis as it should be played, you can of course have it with your 2 to 3 years or 2 to 4 years old hardware constellation effectively. But more important is it's what I use the term lead gamer. No, lead gamer is effectively somebody who has the top hand hardware, has all the best games, but talks to his friends, gamers, and leads them effectively. Mm-hmm. And so Crysis is a game for lead gamer, hardcore gamer, enthusiast at the high-end market, but at the same time fulfills the people who don't have the deep pockets. Mm-hmm.
For the people that don't have the deep pockets and are playing, is there enough to the game to sort of sustain itself and to justify itself as being something to pay attention to if you're not having the visual veneer applied to it?
Yes, because the bar it's very simple. In 2 to 3 years ago, like when I look at Crysis and let's say Far Cry, right? I compare them because we developed both of them. So if you play Crysis min-spec effectively, it will look somewhere between high to very high in Far Cry. So if you were happy with Far Cry, you'll be happy with Crysis, but at the same PC. But to play Crysis at high end, very high, you have to buy a new PC. It's a generational jump. I mean, Crysis is one generation, Far Cry. Crysis is the next generation, you know? So that needs a new generation of PC. At the same time, it scales even further now. So from that angle, yes, you will be able to play single player. There's no, effectively no gameplay difference. Frame rates might vary, visuals might vary. But the immersion factor coming through the visuals, coming through the amount of simulations around you, that will only be really present on the high-end configurations. And but from the gameplay, from the action itself, it won't differ. So it will be the same. And multiplayer is a bit different story. So we went extra miles. Like, we could have made just a one version multiplayer, right, in Power Struggle, and say, okay, we have one multiplayer version that scales, has different configurations. But we went the extra step to make sure Power Struggle, in this case, receives a DX10 version. But the DX10 version is not related to DX10 per se. We took only the opportunity of moment, if you want, and said, hey, with the introduction of 8800 and the DX10 notion, we could use it and cut off the min specs to introduce next generation of online gaming, you know, as a minimum hardware base. Because anybody who has an 8800 or plus in the future, he can play with time of day now, with physics, with breakables, in a multiplayer game that feels like a single player experience. And so we took that as an opportunity. And at the same time, we have the DX9 multiplayer for the people of now or the past. Because when I develop a game, I always think of how can we make sure that this is a game for the past, for the present, and for the future? How can we scale the 5 years, essentially? 3 years in the past and 2 years in the future. That's kind of the bandwidth. Because if I have a favorite game, I want to play it like for the 5 years, you know, ideally. So when I play my favorite game today, it's going to look the same again. But Crysis in 2 years will look different. It will look better than today.
So do you expect it to be, you know, selling strongly 2 years from now and then 5 years from now?
Well, if Crysis becomes classic in people's mind, gamers' mind, there will be a good reason why you can buy Crysis still in 2 years and it's going to be still state of the art. Because it will adapt and configure itself to the high-end configurations. So you will get so by the time in 2 years, if a game doesn't appear with similar gameplay that competes in gameplay and on the adapted visuals, so it's going to be still state-of-the-art gameplay and state-of-the-art visuals. Usually a classic game does become outdated by visuals but remains classic by gameplay. Mm-hmm. So Crysis hopefully will remain classic by gameplay and adapt to be trendy in visuals all the time. That's the philosophy behind it.
Well, I remember back when you released Far Cry, I forget exactly how long after, but you updated that to a 64-bit version.
Yes.
So I mean, so theoretically, you could just continue following up with Crysis and add on to that later.
Yeah, I mean, we have it built in now. That's a good thing. Is in Crysis, we learned from Far Cry, and people appreciated it. So we said we could build a part of this already in, but we still have to, because we don't know the profiles of future hardware. We know only about 6 or 9 months out. So we have prototypes of new hardware, but we don't know what will NVIDIA or RTI or AMD or Intel will come up in the next 2 years. You know, I mean, they won't tell us at the stage still. But as soon we know any information, we will auto-patch Crysis with some profile hints. And as soon you buy it, the game will start configuring to that configuration. So with much thinner patches. And we may do content upgrades in addition, like higher res textures, like quadruple textures, for example. We may use it in a half year, 1 year, but we will try to maintain surely the shaders, the content. We will hopefully do it, but minimum the profile. So I guarantee you in 2 years from now, you can ask me that 2 years again. You should. In 2 years from now, you will have a Crysis that is completely different in visual quality than today. It will look just better, and it will be our goal and strive will be to make sure Crysis is always leading in the experience and release it now, but keep it there, keep it up there, essentially.
In your analogy, you know, you were basically positioning Crysis as the blonde bombshell who also has a PhD. And granted that the way that the game looks is not entirely separate from the way that the game plays. The two are interrelated. But putting that aside for a moment, what specifically is the nature of the PhD of Crisis, the blonde bombshell?
Well, it's intelligence. The artificial intelligence, which makes her, or Crisis in effect, intelligent. The artificial technology we spend in to refine just even the one-on-one combat. Like, you against one AI feels substantially more intelligent and tuned through the AI quality and level design, in fact, that I feel that our game feels more intelligent, more requires you to think more. So it needs more challenging in terms of outsmarting the experience. So that alone is one aspect. Second aspect is all the AI technology we added for the, for example, for the aliens, for the whole driver AI, for the pilot AI, for the squad match squad AI. Not like that we have whole squad tactics, but they stay not in your way at least. So this is actually an achievement in games today. If you look at AI technology. And the other things like assessing the environments, the way they assess, the way the sensors work. In Far Cry, we had just vision, but in Crysis, we have peripheral vision and vision. You know, like we have this vision and this vision, effectively. Mm-hmm. Like a view of Rustum of 90 degree and 180 degree simulations that that tunes the stealth gameplay. So, and now they have also in the context of, are you too very visible or not? Like they evaluate the visibility more. And they can differentiate between what they hear, how loud they hear.
I remember one of the original criticisms we had back in Far Cry 1 was that the AI almost seemed too aware of your presence, especially right at first.
Yeah.
Where you would pop around a corner and a guy from real far away.
That won't happen anymore. So that's exactly this kind of things we nailed down as well. Mm-hmm. We were criticized for the difficulty of Far Cry. We were criticized for AI that can see same quality in near you or distance. So now the peripheral vision and the vision changed by distance and by the context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the vision sensors are tuned and next generation now through that, and that refines the core gameplay. Now, for example, if you run behind a bush, he was still shooting it, but in Far Cry, there was a moment, for example, if the bush was closer to me and I run into the behind the bush, the AI would spray fire because he would see I'm running behind the bush to take cover, but he's not stupid. He sees, hey, you just run in, so he's going to shoot into the bush, right?
Mm-hmm.
But where the system failed was that it didn't check this is when the player ran into behind the bush, but the bush was closer to the AI. What means that the bush was just in the path of the AI and the player, but the player didn't deliberately run into the bush. The AI just thought, hey, he's running behind a bush. That felt like cheating because the bush was like AI was 2 meters, it was a bush, and 50 meters the player was. And so this looked like cheating because he didn't understand the bush actually is not for me, but for in front of him. I don't know if it makes sense.
No, it does.
Point of view. Why do you think that that now for games like yours, that like this, just listening to you talk about the AI, it seems like it must be so hard for you guys to do and to think of all those situations and to get to the enemies to think and react in that way. And if you think back to older FPSs, I mean, you know, the Dooms and Quakes or whatever, I mean, these were monsters that just ran straight at you with no intelligence, and we all lived with that. So why do you think it's different now?
The difference is very simple, because we don't have corridors, we don't have strict scenarios where we exactly know what the player will do. In fact, we don't want. Not that we don't, it's not a bad thing that we don't have it. In fact, we deliberately decided not to have it. The whole point about our game is that I want the player to think before he does anything. And that's the core gameplay difference in Far Cry introduced, and I think it's a concept which we, as our first game, we kind of did it, but it was like an apprenticeship work still, and we perfectioned it. This is Crysis now. We said this is something like we said we have something here cool, and this coolness now outsmarting gameplay, we have to refine at the core of Crysis, and so we took all the know-how and critique from Far Cry, and really focused on the one-on-one combat itself to nail that. Once we had that in mind, like once that we had in place, we then said, okay, let's work on the group tactics. Like, let's make the group really be intelligent and smart. Now they have to react on different distances, different audio profiles, how loud you are, visibility profiles, your suit modes, the environment, you know, which context you are. So the complexity of the AI, what to recognize and to analyze, is way bigger than ever in Far Cry. Mm-hmm. And that is to accommodate the PhD degree of the player, or the blonde PhD degree thing you were talking before, Sean. The fact that the Crysis has a nanosuit, configurable weapon system, the open environments, effectively, the different daytime settings, everything together, that needs an encounter that actually can encounter intelligently. And then we invested a lot about the pathfinding system in Crysis, which actually... The AI has to, once he knows what to do, he has to go to a position. Now, in Far Cry, the world was static. Mm-hmm. In Crysis, the world is completely dynamic. Now, again, it needs much more AI technology behind it to make the player AI position intelligently in a world that is dynamic. A complete different challenge is obstacle avoidance, dynamic path navigation networks, like things which...
It's one reason why with Fear, which is, you know, among critics is regarded as having excellent AI, but in that game, all the environments and the context in which that AI can act out, its various options are pretty constrained.
Yes, completely.
They're designed very specifically to foster and encourage specific
behaviors. And they did a great job for that.
Yeah, but I mean, and you're talking about environments where rather than... A series of rooms interconnected by three hallways, you know, and you have a very finite set of entry points and exit points for your AI actors. You have a field with rocks, trees, you know, shacks, and all these other things.
We have a sandbox.
And you, right.
Mm-hmm. And we have a sandbox where the player can come from anywhere. He can use anything he has. He can use an unsuit mode, and he can be playing as a long range, as an action guy, as a tactical, as stealth. Like all different playstyles are fully featured, you know. Where you would need normally four games to play with, this is like all gameplay styles, play styles in one, and encountered by an AI that can actually assess both and give you a good experience by that.
So, do you worry at all that the players are going to be able to, because it's so open and there's so many ways to do it, and the AI has so much work to do, that they'll be able to find some seams or some cracks where they can slip through and fool the game? Or are you confident at this point that you?
I'm confident we found all these things, but. You know, I won't, like, bet my whole life on it.
Right.
But I hope it won't happen. But the thing is, the fact is that the AI is still intelligent enough. So if the player finds, let's say, somewhere a polygonal edge where he can shoot through, the AI will try to still flush him out and things like this. So there's some exception handling we implemented. Mm-hmm. But principally, our goal was to make sure that the AI reacts on being shot at as a number one rule. That means, so if you shoot at him, no matter where you are, the AI is going to shoot back to you somehow, mm-hmm. you know. So there will be a worst-case scenario still will be handled with combat.
And if they can't shoot you, they will find a way to move closer to you.
Yes, or throw grenades at you. So there will be ways how they will attack you. Mm-hmm. But principally, again, the sum of technology we added, and I want to, because I'm getting off track of the PhD thing, because there's much more about what Crysis makes intelligent. The AI technology is one thing, but the level design itself. The level design, the systems in terms of the nanosuit and the customized weapon system, the whole thing that the entire gameplay asks you as a gamer to think about it. And so I say it this way, if a girl which I meet is brainless, she wouldn't ask me questions, right? She wouldn't make me think. So I would just think she's hot. But that hot girl, which has PhD degree, is actually getting more interest of me because she's also asking the interesting questions that might be a bit more substance in the relationship, you know? So Crysis will have a better relation to the gamer, for sure.
In the spectrum of storytelling in FPSs, you know, that will include, you know, Halo at one position on it, Half-Life series, and then maybe some of the earlier, the original Doom games. Where that would be on the very, you know, extreme of a spectrum, where it's basically just action. Where do you see both, you know, Crytek as a studio's position on it, and specifically the game Crysis? I mean, where does it fall in there? And so to define this better, so say for example in Halo, you have an emphasis on cutscenes, you know, where you'll have action that's very similar to what you're describing, where it's about the tactics, it's about the feedback of the combat and stuff, but maybe with a lesser emphasis on the sense of immersion and you know the realness of the environment or something like that. And then you know with Half-Life or something or even BioShock, where you're never interrupting the game. to show you a movie that's not a part of a game, technically mm-hmm. speaking, you know.
Okay.
So, you know, where in that... You know, where in that spectrum is your game? Because people, we talk about the action all the time, but we don't. We do talk about the story insofar as we know aliens come, Koreans are here, Americans are there, and we all end up fighting. But what about?
I think the one thing you have to understand is, I think what you should do is, because the story is something. I mean, we always are encountered with technology questions and with game, like with AI questions. And I see some of the other game interviews where they only talk about story and only talk about visuals, depending on the strengths of the studio, it seems to be. I actually was saying it to Andrew, why they don't talk about the story or characters, etc. to us, but they say, well, you know, you're looked at as like the studio. I said, well, we need to change that, you know. So, principally, the way we emphasize story a lot in terms of making sure we tell a good story. But at the same time, I want to say that we're not a story... that requires a PhD degree to understand, either. Like, speaking of PhD degrees again, that means that if you, it's very easy to follow, mm-hmm. has characters, the typical character set up, but also it's important that it we don't tell a story through cutscenes, through cutscenes which are out of your view, mm-hmm. Or through radio messages, or through tapes you find, or speakers, well, like in a way that it's through VO, effectively. But what we do is we show the story,
right? It consists entirely of verbs, right? I mean, insofar as you have a story there, it's happier.
It's a plot that happens, but the plot is directly correlated to all the objectives and the action the player does, mm-hmm. and everything you do has a meaningful. Development for the characters or for you as a gamer, and you bring the story forward. But usually what happens is some games, there's a world already which is in a state, a fixed state, and has effectively a backstory only. And what happens is that you find out through nuggets of information what happened there to get to the state. In Crysis, the world alone, the environment is a framework, and the island itself is a framework, a character that evolves effectively to tell a story, but not through dialogues that is spoken to you, but rather through the visual transformation of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, the world evolves around you as you go through the actions which are correlated to your objectives, and the objectives are correlated to the overarching story. So I feel that all the core gameplay we talked about, the sandbox experience, are always converge into the moments where something happens around you in the world, but in through visuals and through animations, that means, shit, the world is changing. You know, something's happening here again. So that's how we tell the stories, through the ambient storytelling, number one, as a method. Ambience by being the visual ambience, the world. The second way, the means for us in terms of story is developing a plot rather a backstory. So very important is there is a situation in the world, but the situation and your original mission changes completely. Everything develops and everything transforms. And last but not least, I want to say that story, in terms of cutscenes, we have cutscenes in the game, but they're always in the point of view of the player. So whilst we interrupt the gameplay action, we don't take it away the player view.
Is that a tradition? Are you talking more about, like, you know, say, for example, there are moments in BioShock or Half-Life or something where they will constrain player movement?
Yeah, so constrained, that,
you know, so that you're still able to look around, but it's keeping you in a place so that people are able to, like, make their marks and act in a way. And then a cutscene, sometimes you'll get a letterboxing effect and it will play through.
No, it's actually a hybrid of that. It's first-person view, but it's letterboxed because we want to tell you something there, mm-hmm. and we want you to listen to it. And if you don't listen, it's okay because there's still ambient information enough to tell you what's going on anyway. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to keep the story in some chunks delivered to you to converge the sandbox experience and to bring the story forward effectively through points of storytelling methods, but through crafted and choreographed cutscenes, mm-hmm. but they're always from the first person view. That's for me important. So you will never see yourself in third person effectively.
Clearly, I mean, I got the hint when I visited you guys in Frankfurt before that Crysis, I mean, you had big plans for it. That you already talked about. I mean, you more or less were talking about the notion that Okay, let's back it up, because here's something that changed. This was an important change. Originally, you had the alien ship crash lands in the South Chinese Sea.
Yes.
Creates this, you know, tsunami and all this stuff. And now, when I last spoke with you, the notion is instead more like War of the Worlds, where these things are – things, you know, is where I'm getting at. But this thing in the first Crisis game is already there.
First Crisis.
Buried in the earth. And then it's exposed, you know, by some sort of activity. It activates or something. Yeah. But so before you were saying, you know, an armada of these things are coming toward Earth, and now I would assume the equation would just change to, again, like War of the Worlds, there's an armada of them already buried throughout the planet.
The thing is, we don't know. And even in the end of the game, you don't know. What you know is that effectively, well, you know, this would be a spoiler, what I'm talking about. But I will not try to spoil it. So the way I see this is, Crisis is encapsulated in terms of what happened there. So it tells a story what happened, okay, about some of the backstory, but also develops the plot so that what happened is like in a time frame of, I would say, 1.5 hour into the game. Then about 1.5 hour later, you start actually moving things forward to the point to find out what happened and things what's happening now till the end of the game. But the question whether there are more of them completely is unanswered, in fact. And I would say that might be likely.
Right. Here's another approach to it. Put it this way, Chabot. EA would be very well served to have a premier first-person shooter franchise.
Yeah, sure.
Like, clearly, it's got to, like, you know, just from a business perspective, you look, Activision's got Call of Duty, which is doing very well, you know, Halo. There are various other no-brainers, and that's one category that, in my mind at least, and this is subjective, you know, other people might disagree, you might disagree, but they do not, at the time, EA does not have a first-person shooter that's premier, in the sense that it is, like, people look to it in the way you would Call of Duty, in the way you would Halo, with the exception of Crisis. So if it's successful to the point where, you know, you're in a partnership with them now, but it's not direct. I mean, they don't own the studio or anything. Mm-hmm. Would you? And you've already been in a situation where you've lost control of a creation, Far Cry. Would you?
No,
if the game's
lost,
super successful, will you give the whole thing over to EA, or you just assume? I assume you'd continue to work with them on it, but I mean, just thinking that far ahead, I mean, it's got to be in your studio's mind right now, because you're on the verge right now of finding out if your game is going to be a success to that degree or it's not.
No, that's it's completely different topics. The way I want to explain it, first of all, it's Far Cry. We didn't lose it. We sold, actually, the rights to Ubisoft.
Okay.
So they just can do whatever they want with it. And it was a bit of a hard move for us, but we wanted to focus that money to create something new. So that means with Crysis, for example, our new creation now, the fact that Crysis actually from the design on is a more than one version, effectively, is already, I think, no secret.
Console.
No, I didn't say console. I said there's more than one version. So what I mean is that the story is not finished yet completely with the first version of the game. In fact, it's designed to be a trilogy, but what happens in terms of whether the big question is, will we start working on Crysis 2 right away? And the answer to that is, it really depends on how much request is for that. Not from publisher side, but from the fan side mainly. How does it do business-wise? And also, I think the most important potentially, how does the team feel about jumping right away into sequel? Say it this way. Our studio is pretty young still. We just finished, we started 2001, we finished 2004 Far Cry, we could have done Far Cry 2, but in my mind, and my two brothers' mind, effectively, as this was three yearly brothers, we said, hey, we just established a culture who drive for innovation and innovation and innovation, you know? And after Far Cry, we said, because there was a lot of people who thought, hey, we could do Far Cry 2 like this, you know, like nothing. Like, it's so, we learned so much, we can do it extremely fast. And I was afraid of that mood in the company, because I thought that mood is counterproductive right now. If we look at it as a sequel development right away, then we may lose the edge we had, you know, as a culture. We just developed a culture which we needed to manifest. Mm-hmm. And so we said,
could you have called Crysis Far Cry 2 though? I mean, no. In that stretch, in the sense
no,
that some
completely not because we said when we because Far Cry 2 would have done with CryEngine 1, it just would have continued. But for Crysis, we said, guys, we're gonna make a new IP. There was like we had a company meeting. We said we have decided we make a new IP, new engine, new everything. You know, everybody was like, what? Like, we spent so much time on working the new engine, writing the engine, and finishing Far Cry. We should leverage on it.
Why that determination to do your own engine?
Well, this is for me, it's just a matter of controlling fate in the company. Like, I don't want to rely to anybody else at the core of our game for success of our title. Because it inherently drives gameplay, and that should be in our hands.
Is there any kind of a regional thing there, too? I mean, because something I also wanted to ask you about was about the German market and your fans there. And how I'm sure, like, you'll see that there's a sense of pride involved that, you know, that the game is coming from a studio that's based in Germany. And also, is it another way of kind of like saying, like, yeah, all you know, premier engines do not have to come from, you know, the same two or three locations.
Yeah, but there was not the motivation for it. This was not even in the somewhere close to the mind, in my mind. But to come back a bit again to the topic, yeah. Because for me, Crysis was about the development of Crysis. For me, was about establishing a culture that strives for innovation and pushes the boundaries. And we had this culture developed, and I wanted to manifest it into our studio. After Crysis, now this team has been pushed 2 times effectively with working on new IPs and new technologies. Now we have a culture that exists as a company. And for me, forming the company is more important than making the games.
So in theory now, you think you could... So you could go on to a Crysis 2
yes.
And feel that you've now pushed yourselves enough.
Yes, without losing the edge, without losing the culture of Crytek. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because if you would have entered a sequel right away, it would have been, okay, we're not just new IP, but now we're also sequel. And I wanted to make a Crytek an IP creator mm-hmm. as a primary goal. And even if we do the sequel now, we would make sure it has enough innovation that is actually not just continuing the story, but actually has truly core gameplay innovations in itself and technical innovations as we used to. So it has to stay true to our culture and what consumers and our gamers, fans, happen to learn by now. I mean, when they play now Crysis after Far Cry, they will be 2 times received games which push them and in terms of quality, in terms of perception of gameplay, in terms of their mindsets, like they have to think before they shoot. It's not a stupid shooter, it's an intelligent shooter. And once they get used to that, they will expect this to follow. And so for me, that's now the opportunity where we can follow it effectively as a culture to serve to that purpose. And so that means the Crysis 2 is much right now is much more likely than Far Cry 2 ever was.
Unlike id, say, though, where they, you know, retained Wolfenstein, Doom, and Quake and then went back and forth on them. I mean, you sold Far Cry, so I was just wondering if you were thinking that maybe there wasn't enough distinct, that the scenarios and everything in that world that you created weren't distinct enough to merit maintaining and retaining. You know, I mean, you could go on and do all these other things, and it's not
We needed the financial. We wanted to increase our independence and control, creative control. Mm-hmm. So we had to essentially create a financial background, and the only way was to sell the baby one and, yeah, make a new baby.
Right.
So is it still hard to you to have lost that baby then?
Yeah, of course.
Well, I mean, to see a new one too. That's out now.
Visitation rights occasionally. You know?
Yeah, we got.
But you
may
knew
adopt it back.
At the time you sold it, you knew that they were going to make a Far Cry 2.
Yeah, of course, and
all the Xbox ones, the Instincts, and
right. So how do you feel about those? I mean, do you or as much as you want to get into or the thought of a Far Cry 2?
I
mean,
yeah, I
have
think,
you specifically Far Cry 2? I mean, have you looked at it? You were just at games convention, right?
Yeah, but I was there for 4 hours and I had to go back to the office right away.
Okay.
So I didn't see anything, unfortunately. I saw screenshots and I read the reviews on some magazines and I found it very interesting. Actually, the funny thing is, it's very interesting because we had conceptual drafts for the Far Cry franchise, which were a bit similar, but the entire Africa scene and the scenario of Africa, I found is an interesting take on the outer scenarios.
That's holy.
Yeah, so I dig it, and I'm happy that they don't follow the instinct powers, because I felt they were a bit edgy. I am sad that they dropped Jack Carver. Jack Carver was funny. I found it cool. Redshirt was cool. You know how long it took to pick the redshirt? It was really funny.
You should pick up the red shirt when you were also doing in Hawaii and wherever else reference shoots.
The point of the red shirt was really interesting. Just a little story for that. We had at one point like a draft of Hawaiian shirts, and people said we should take green. It's camouflage. I said no. It should be the opposite. It should be actually literally like the contrast to the scenery. You know.
So is that where the whole frozen jungle thing was born?
Yeah,
the red shirt in the jungle. Ice next.
Red shirt to frozen environment. No, red shirt wouldn't work. That would have to be the yellow nano suit, but it's not yellow. Yeah. Unfortunately not.
Banana suit.
Banana suit. Banana suit. No, let's not start that. Yeah.
Okay, so about the blonde. That's played.
Yeah, the blonde suit. No, the shirt was a fun story, but about emotions regarding Far Cry 2. I mean, I'm going to look at it always special. For me, whilst we will compete with it, effectively, for me, it's still not like the other competitions, in a sense. So it's different. I'm looking at it different. And I really hope they will pull it off great. Mm-hmm. Just for that matter. I wish I will play Far Cry 2 and say, wow. Because one thing I said after finishing Far Cry and after finishing Crash, I will say it again. One of the most difficult things is if you... And know that people want this game and the game is really in a certain quality bar. For you, it's extremely difficult to experience that game as any fun. And so one of the big dilemmas of a developer always is that you will never have fun with your own games, right? So, and Far Cry 2 would be a really interesting thing for me because I didn't have fun with Far Cry playing it afterwards. Actually, I had fun after 1 year later when I played it again. Because I forgot myself quite a few things about Far Cry. And so I played it again. I said, damn, this was really funny, you know. So in Far Cry 2, it will be very interesting to look at and play.
Did you go on message boards to see, you know, what people are saying now that Ubisoft re-released it as a free game but with ads inside of it? Just to see. I mean, do you still care what people say about it? Or?
No, I had no US. Chance to see. Yeah. It was just recently, right?
Just recently over here.
Like from the outer world of Crytek, like what happens around Crytek at this last couple of weeks, I didn't.
Right.
I couldn't concentrate on because of the fact that we are every day we're working like crazy monkeys right now.
Would you be making Crysis, you know, the game that it is now, a PC only game, you know, with DX10 support, if not for the existence of the European, especially the German market? So that's to say, would you, if the, say your European market didn't even exist, would you still be making this game you're making now in the way that you're making it and for the...
You know, that's the thing. We didn't really care about markets.
Yeah?
With the funding? Yeah, we said now just let's do what we want to do. And that was it. There was no market research, analysis whatsoever.
So why was the PC thing? Why that we need to make this PC game?
Well, there are two things. Anybody else was jumping to consoles? Like our competitions, and we said, look, the market by no means will fall that fast that anybody can go and there will be no market left, you know. So developers leave, the products leave, the market does degrade for the offline games, but not as fast as the products leaving the market. So I saw very simple pragmatic decision. If we focus on XP and Longhorn back then, we still now, if we focus on that market, and really tighten our partnerships and focus on making the best PC game, we can have a substantially higher market on that, if you want. Like, if you want the reason why focusing on them, that was the consequence, how we could win. But the game design itself, the platform was a market choice for us. And also, mm-hmm. just leading by our experience high-end graphics, so we can push it. It's an opportunity, partnerships, opportunities. Competitor leaving opportunity, mm-hmm. you know, not a sign that we leave too, but rather not like a lead penguin that jumps and we jump also, but rather let them jump. We have more space for ourselves now. Mm-hmm. So that was the analogy. And then we said, what do we do? What kind of game? And then we said, this decision was not after finishing Far Cry. This decision was somewhere in the mid of 2003, before finishing Far Cry. And we said that in the future we will stay on PC. So we always worked on the consoles testing things. I mean, we tested GameCube, we tested PS2. We had a polybump, our normal mapping technology, and running a PS2. We showed it to Sony. Nobody else has it in the world even today. But we had the normal mapping technology running. Mm-hmm. We had it running on GameCube.
So is that the equivalent of like normal mapping on a PS2 then? Like true?
Yeah, truly normal mapping. We had the specular point lights, everything, anti-aliasing. We had it running on PS2.
Well, but just a straight tech test?
Yeah, just to see if we were to own PS2, how we would push this platform. And we want to challenge ourselves. We did it. After 8 months, we had first results. It was really awesome. But we realized also we could never port Far Cry to PS2. It's impossible. But we would have to make a new IP. And we were almost actually doing it. But we said, last minute, we said, no, PC, guys, PC. And we constantly researched PS3, 360, Nintendo Wii, us here and there. Nintendo Wii, not that much. But we always research those platforms. But the company culture is clearly PC-driven and will stay like this, even in the future. So I can bet on it.
We were talking before we hit record on this about, you know, how you can use a controller for multiplayer.
Yeah, you can.
And, let's just hear about that. I mean, yeah, it's clearly a point of entry for some people that, you know, might be afraid to or just not used to using a mouse for
anything. Just imagine a scenario. In, let's say, in 1 year from now, you have this really, like this monitor, which is 30-inch and plays 2,500 by whatever resolution, okay? I think 2.5 by 1,600 something. And you boot up Crysis at the resolution with anti-aliasing going on, and the new graphic card that you just bought, whatever the NV next, maybe 100 by then, the GT, maybe GeForce 9000, I don't know what will come up 1 year, but probably I'll get in trouble now with Nvidia for that. But the point is that imagine this new graphic card comes out and you have your lead console title as a shooter friend who just played this console, best shooter on the console, and you tell him, here, take the 360 controller on Vista and play it. He will get an experience that no other platform can give you. Even today, he will achieve that. So that's, for me, one of the reasons why we were actually interested in moving on the controller. Mm. So to showcase experiences that are not possible on consoles.
I think that's a good strategy. You know, I mean, I can't knock it just for the fact that I was first a console gamer. And as I graduated to being a PC gamer,
He
graduated to PhD degree as a gamer.
Yeah. It was with the Dreamcast at first because it let me use a mouse and keyboard. But then for the longest time, when I got a PC, I actually played, you know, the original Half-Life with a controller in one hand for the analog and then a mouse in the other. So But it was like it took a while. And then I got off of that and I weaned myself off of that and I learned to use the keys. And then now, you know, I'm at where I'm, you know. So I can say, if you can get someone in the door by saying, yeah, you have an interface that you're comfortable with.
Yep,
and then
absolutely.
By the time that someone gets a PC that's able to run Crysis, you know, I'm assuming they're in the perfect position to sort of acclimate themselves to using the other interface, you know, over time. But you said you can use both in multiplayer, and that just seemed, you know, interesting to me, because without, you know, serious balancing tweaks, or like if you have a controller peer server or something,
that's a setup for
okay, this. So you can say find me a server that supports nothing but controller.
The server side, it can set up all kind of variables to make sure that it's like a joypad.
Do you think that's pretty easy to like cheat or something? Because, you know, I've always wondered on console why they don't support. I mean, there are many reasons involved, but one of the chief reasons that we hear for why you can't plug, you know, into the existing ports on your 360 or something, a mouse and keyboard, is that we don't want to disturb the playing field like this and say, well, why don't you make a peer-based server thing? I mean, is it easy to circumvent that, or do you think that's more of an excuse for other reasons?
In fact, in our case, the servers, if they're controller-based, they can still say controller and keyboard allowed, so it's completely flexible. Honestly, I think it's a matter of market. Like, I think that they assume on the consoles there will be very few people playing with keyboard and mouse, and on PC, the assumption is there will be very few people playing with controller. Mm-hmm. So that alone just makes the business value of that zero for many developers. For us, it's really... to be honest, I would never recommend playing Crysis with Crysis Power Struggle with a controller. You know, it's a PC title. It's a Power Struggle is fast, and I mean very fast, mm-hmm. and it needs a proper and quick reactions. So it needs a proper UI, which is already established itself for shooter. But for the single player experience, for people who come from the console, they're super invited to play it. I think they will have fun with it. But I'm not a console gamer per se. Myself, I know that people actually play tested multiplayer, both Instant Action and Power Struggle controller, and they had fun with their likes. They play. They had fun. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the playfield will be disturbed if the interface is mixed. Of course, that's natural because somebody who plays even with an inherent balance system, like without aiming support, whatnot. Somebody who plays in a mouse and keyboard will always kill somebody who plays with a controller.
Yeah. Conceptually, when I play the Power Struggle beta.
One thing, so I would like to add is the controller has like benefits in. Like steering vehicles and other aspects. Like, particularly when it comes to vehicles, there is some benefit in the controller. So.
Yeah, and as everyone that plays Battlefield knows, they're all really good for flying helicopters and in some cases. I mean, you know.
So there's some cases where it kind of make, if you're dedicated to that kind of playing style or prefer this kind of playing style, you may choose a controller as a preference.
Or have them both plugged in, and when you get an aircraft, pick up the controller.
Yeah.
So one thing I was going to say is that, you know, I've had limited experience with Power Struggle beta, but conceptually I'm super impressed with it. You go in, you've got tactical nukes, you've got, you know, I've used, you know, the various, ice weapons, the heavy, prototype tank and stuff. All this is awesome. But the one impediment I was having is the kind you'd expect in a beta, and that's just performance stuff. And you say that, you know, of course you're optimizing it, but outside of, you know, specific, you know, I don't want to, like, you know, have any kind of like beta questions or give you my list of beta functions now. But since you're making a game that is so cutting edge, you've got like this kind of like reverse scale. When you have multiplayer, people start to prize performance more than anything.
I know.
You want it to look good, but you also, if you're going to play well, you get to the point where you're like, okay, I could. Maybe if that crab that comes up out of the water looks like a box, it's fine as long as I can hit this guy in the head that's been like killing me for the last
30 minutes. I don't believe this. I truly believe that a great gameplay and an upgrade in visuals will find its way into the future. So for me, the most important multiplayer mode we have is Power Struggle DX10. And I'm sure there will be only hundreds of players playing it at the beginning. Hundreds is a bit like exaggerated, but I believe there will be a slow adaptation. I hope it will be big, of course, but we count on Power Struggle DX10 to actually penetrate into the multiplayer gaming scene mm-hmm. over the course of the next year. So, but we want to introduce a DX10 multiplayer. You know, like this was we just say it's a first mover. We will be punished for it because it's a high end burden. But we wanted to take the step now, not in 1 year, not in 2 years, but now, to level out the play field. I mean, if we were to launch a multiplayer only game today. For example, look at this scenario. We cannot afford to cut off the min specs, saying this DX10 only. We can't do that. But we do it because we have, in Crysis, we have Power Struggle, which has DX9. We have Instant Action, and we have Single Player Crysis. Okay? There's enough substance already for that. So we said, let's give this feature element of the multiplayer gaming already into the package, and let's support it and wait, like make sure the gameplay is refined. So DX9. But let's have it there. It will eventually be penetrating, or not penetrating, how do you say? It will be adopted by the different gamers as the months pass by. That's what I'm truly believing it. It is what I believe also like the PS3 looks at the console market right now. I eventually believe PS3 will be still leading, but it takes its time because the adaptation rate is due to different reasons, so the adaptation rate is slowly, but it's getting there. And I think Power Struggle DX10 will be similar. Power Struggle DX9, which you're testing right now, mm-hmm. has performance issues through beta reasons, but also through still optimizations in the rendering, but also in the gameplay code still.
You're pretty confident that those will be ironed out?
Well, we will, of course.
Okay.
I mean, we will do our best to make performance always a topic. But let's not forget, again, Crysis is a high-end title. And we'll live primarily from single player. But the gameplay of a multiplayer it for us was important from a concept point of view that it works, that the network technology is really absolutely optimized.
Yeah.
But the whether that the graphics are demanding is clear.
Right. As long as I was running it on an 8800, it's a GTS, granted, but you know, excellent RAM, everything else is pretty good. What I certainly consider high end, and a lot of other people are definitely going to consider high end as well. So as long as on a system like that, it's optimized to the point. Because then if you get to the point where you're splitting hairs about when you say a future system, and you don't mean, well, hey, someone can go to Circuit City, spend $3,000, and they still aren't getting, you know, satisfactory performance out of it, then that's when I think it could become a problem.
Yeah. I believe that the 8800 GTS will play the game somewhere between mid and high configuration. Mm-hmm. But very high, you will need something more for multiplayer. But then again, for very high, for DX10, to run a 32 match with this next generation of gameplay, you will need an SLI config or something like this. But principally, I don't want to... the one thing I want to mention is that whilst some people are going to pick up the frame rate as an issue on Power Struggle particularly because it's a really demanding system, people should never forget the fact that we have a huge single player. We have a whole multiplayer game in the package too, which is like usually a standalone package itself. And we're going to release also the editor itself. So we have from substance of...
I will vouch for that on a conceptual level and on the way that everything is coming together. Power Struggle alone is as much of a game as Battlefield or Quake Wars or something that, which are...
So what I'm saying is that whilst performance it might be an issue, I think anybody who buys Crysis ultimately has to look at it as the fact that the substance is big. You know, they get effective two games and a whole development tool alongside with it for the price of one game. And for me, and plus the fact that we invested into the future, they get also the future taste of multiplayer, how it will be. Other games, you will see other multiplayer games will migrate to DX10 maybe in 2 years, not now. So the adaptation to DX10 gameplay, not through DX10 API gains, but the performance gains, what the DX10 generation will bring in the future, that gameplay is already included. And we will see other developers adapting to it, not within the next 2 years, just because the fact it's actually a pretty harsh cut. And we took it for the sake of the gaming future of PC.
This other question I think applies to what you're doing. Are you familiar with the game Call of Juarez? It came out of Poland.
Yes, I actually like the game.
Yeah, in the multiplayer, there's an option to use the depth of field feature. If you have enough hardware, you're able to run it. Similarly, you know, you have motion blur in Crysis. But the thing there, though, is that because you have an open system and people with, you know, min specs aren't even able to run it with depth of field. But I found that in the gameplay, by playing the game with it on and off, you're better served with it being off from a pure advantage level of being able to see your environment and whatever. It might be more immersive or realistic to have it on in the same way as motion blur. Mm-hmm. But when it gets too heavy, it's almost like if you're playing to win, you're going to turn those things off. So I was wondering, if in a general thing, just in the future of multiplayer
gaming.
But it's
always like that.
I mean, but do you see that as being an impediment ultimately until you, at least on an open platform like PC,
can't enforce
a standard?
I think that if you look at it, if you look at the next-gen gameplay we're introducing with the DX10, we have day-night cycles, we have the physics gameplay, breakability, etc. We use DX10 effectively to gain on performance and what it gains in performance, and we essentially use the system capacities more. So this because we assume somebody who runs 8800 also has a certain CPU capacity, right? So he can go to very high. If he can do that, we automatically use the system to compress data more on the network, so we can play on the network traffic more. So we can effectively populate the game more rich. And whether somebody can turn off the features, if they don't change gameplay. Like, for example, my nephew, who's playing multiplayer Power Struggle Beta, he has 8800 Ultra. But the way he plays it is at the low configuration. I said, why don't you turn on the features? He says, well, I'm playing to win, you know? Like, I want high frame rate. Same as when I played the first time Quake 3 Arena. What did I do? Take the textures almost off, actually, as much as we can, mm-hmm. in order to get the high frame rate. So... But at the same time, I said, well, you know what, I'm a more like a visual purist, so I want to see the graphics of that. So I enabled all the highest resolution, the highest configuration I could get, but the price is frame rate. So I think that the multiplayer, that the gameplay is more important. Well, it's granted.
It sounds like you need also another server that like limits people playing on a, like, you know, like if you want a server where people agree to all use motion blur and depth of field and stuff.
Well, motion blur depth of field is a topic which I think in the beta our motion blur was too much happening.
Right.
That was one of the reasons why people are angry. It's already addressed, in fact. They're bringing it up and some community members brought up already.
Yeah, it was very intense.
Yeah. But a principal thing is, one of the reasons why DXN actually has multiplayer impact in gameplay impact in multiplayer is because gameplay is more important in multiplayer. Gameplay benefits is more of a reason why to migrate to new generation of a platform, and gameplay is more important in anything in multiplayer than the visual feast. But I believe still, like, there are people who are jumping from Counter-Strike to other games step by step, because at one point the visual just doesn't cut it anymore. Why did we see a Counter-Strike upgrade? Because the visuals doesn't cut it anymore too, compared to other games. And the customer who sees a game, high-end game, and then she sees a Counter-Strike, says, why does Counter-Strike 1, granted, look so bad? So there needed to be an upgrade. Even after the upgrade, what did we see? The migration doesn't happen that fast. Still, people prefer the original, because it just runs fast and the gameplay is iron, right? So I think Power Struggle in the next 1 year to 3 years after that will become completely in the topic. It's high-end demanding, but gameplay will be refined as we go. And we will nail the gameplay to perfect balance, and the hardware will catch up eventually. And that's where we think that Power Struggle will win. It's conceptually. Conceptually, we tested it for the last 12 months, and we refined it actually quite drastically. And we think it has all the ingredients to be number one title, but it takes time to get there, essentially. So right out of the box, you would have to probably turn down the visuals if you want the kills. But if you want a average out experience with your friends, like where everybody plays in a high setting, you can have a great experience.
Cool. You guys have been chatting for a while. You guys have any questions?
Actually, you hit my questions I was going to ask, so...
How are we doing? How are we doing on time?
We've been yammering for an hour.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I had one.
It's because I asked so many. It's answered so long.
Hey, no, your answers are awesome.
That's great.
Do you... I'm wondering about if there is a difference in either gaming expectations or even play styles amongst... that you've seen or experienced amongst European gamers versus American gamers, say, like, are they? I'm not as a way to start any kind of culture war here. I'm just curious, like, if German or French or English gamers or anyone over there, Eastern European PC gamers,
we're the connection, if anything, as PC players. I would say, we probably have as hardcore an American hardcore PC player. I would guess we have a good deal, at least as much in common with, you know, another hardcore German or Swedish or Finn PC player as we do between, like, say, Joe Console in America and Super Tech.
Well, this is what I'm asking. Like, are we all the same, or do you perceive differences? I mean, like, in your experience with Far Cry, say, or maybe the kind of questions you're getting on the forums about Crysis, or is there just nothing that stands out to you?
Interesting. Well, the culture differences, the only thing what we saw was that usually the American audience usually pays more attention to the visual itself. And the European audience usually tends to look at the gameplay as their primary reason.
Or more superficial.
Yeah, a little bit more. I mean, that's if you... like, Americans look Europe always like a more sophisticated by its culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, already. And the Europeans always look at the Americans, unfortunately, superficial, being superficial and being too much, superficial, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are.
And so, I assume...
I'm not going to go there. I was going to talk about a specific video.
And I assume...
box opening.
Yeah, maybe we should talk about whatever this is.
Sorry, it's inside there. Nothing.
But principally...
I just need to epitomize the superficiality, though.
Principally, I believe the gamers, so they don't, like, the elite gamer audience I was talking before, they don't differentiate. You know, they want from everything. They want the blonde was a PhD, effectively.
What about
just
interface?
The blonde?
So, because I've heard, you know, from some European developers will say that there's a lot more forgiveness for, or that Americans expect a more streamlined and easier to use interface than some of the European audience is going to demand. And then they'll use something like Armed Assault as an example, which to people that are used to playing Ghost Recon and its recent incarnations, you know, would just look at Armed Assault, also called Arma, and say, what the hell is going on here?
Mm-hmm. I think it's the UI, designing a UI that is easy to enter is a general rule of design anyway. So if somebody designs a product saying, you know, our Europeans will get it, American market don't care, I think this is flawed by definition already.
Have you seen people make that decision?
No, no. Okay. But what I'm saying is you seem to imply that somehow Arma was done with this in mind or not, or they didn't care, or Ghost Recon took more challenge in UI design so that the game is accessible for the US market. There are probably some US market consolidations here and there, but for example, during the development of Far Cry or during the development of Crysis, there were no considerations. There's one thing, so... Actually, one topic which came up, probably consequently all the time again, was the amount of gore.
Mm.
That was one thing which was like basically told, Americans like gore and Europeans don't, you know? And so that was a constant topic. And even within our studio, with American voices and European voices, the amount, the call for gore usually came from the American camps versus
Jack LeMay. Is he still?
Yeah. Unfortunately, he's not with us anymore. But American voices, other like Chris Evans or some other guys, were asking for it. But bottom line is, I think it's also a miss. You know, I think the general demand of gore or non-gore is actually defined by our state of happiness generally, like in the movies,
cultures, you mean, or
yeah, like as nations, in fact.
So
I think.
We like gore more because we're unhappy.
We're just definitely unhappy.
I don't know what's happening here in America, but
yeah, you're probably right.
But I think there's some. Typically in the movie industry, the pick of theme of the movie, or the amount, whether drama is in trend, whether comedy is in trend, usually is correlated to the economical state of the company, of the country. Mm-hmm. And usually the movies are designed, like in World War, you had comedies mainly as a huge contrast to what's going on in the world, right? So because people were depressed, so they needed hope. You know, or science fiction movies.
Well, actually, I just read an article about the movie industry in the U.S. right now that talked about the movies that are out now and the movies that are coming out for the rest of the year, that there's a great amount of very violent movies that are prestige movies. You know, some of the art movies, even like this Jodie Foster Brave One thing, and
it's crazy.
No Country for Old Men coming out. That and the analysis was saying that like the country psyche here in the U.S. is a little bit disturbed right now.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It might be only that reason, really. Because for me, for example, the amount of gore what I see nowadays, like I saw the trailer of the new Rambo, the amount of gore that movie trailer showed, I was shocked.
That was insane.
I was shocked by it. Really,
more shocked than how old Stallone looked. that was the scariest part.
Yeah, that was okay. But the point is that I was shocked the amount of gore, how much gore was there, and I think this must be related to the current state of America. Because, but I can't explain what's happening, obviously. It's not, we never took a deliberate design analysis on this. But bottom line is, that was the only theme or discussion topic I remember now, which came up. And
you can't get out of it there, because you're making a game that's Americans versus Koreans, at least for part of it.
Yeah.
So you're clearly willing to comment on things.
Yeah.
So let's hear it.
So you want me to comment on the fact that you're shooting North Koreans?
Well, no, just what I mean. The fact you're making a game where that has a representation of America in some respect, however minor, even if it's you know.
Yeah, largely. I know, but you know what people are calling. You should the arm should tear off, the head should blow off when you shoot a rocket launcher on them. The body should disassemble. I said no, you know, it's not. it's not tasty. And as a game, I think the presentation of action has to be still done in a sophisticated way, but not over top with amount of gore or blood. Mm-hmm. Gore and blood for me is always a matter, is a cheap way to punctuate action. And when I say cheap way, I mean it's simple to shock an audience by amount of blur, mm-hmm. but it's more difficult to shock and catch audience by a good representation. Mm-hmm. Some representation which is not for the shocked by the gore, maybe it's cause it's but by the action intensity.
Maybe it's because it's easier to blow up and jib a character than it is to have the ragdoll not look like
in
a
fact,
ragdoll.
In fact, to be honest, I said like technically it's simple. Technically, it's always simpler, to be honest.
To just have lots of gore or splatting blood.
Yeah, I mean, just...
Have you played Team Fortress 2?
No.
Okay, because that's
I want to
super...
play it, but I didn't have time. I have to finish Crysis.
As you know, it's super abstracted, you know, very cartoon-like.
If
and
I would
it's
do abstract,
super gory.
Yeah, if I would do abstract, to
and
be it, honest, I would go
to
also.
Work remarkably well because of that yeah. abstraction.
The good thing about gore cartoonish. Is... The good thing is about gore is that it simplifies, of course, the communication of a hit, you know? Mm-hmm. You hit something, boom.
Yeah.
It's a lot of blood. So it's very clear from any distance whatsoever. The hit reaction of sophisticated... I say sophisticated because it needs more sophisticated like impulse physics and particles that are not too much but subtle enough that you can recognize it in shooting ranges, etc. So it takes much more work to make it still work.
It's a cheap sell too, though. I mean, we have to admit it. I mean, look at the history of games. I mean, when Mortal Kombat, remember that era when Mortal Kombat first came out and there were games like Time Killers and they were all about, you know, you chainsaw off someone's arm, and even though they were just, they look like complete crap by today's standards, at the time you're like, oh man, did you see that? And while I, you know, there are a number of reasons that it works, like in Gears of War, because it indicates, you know, it's feedback. You know, yes, you are shooting this guy, and it's doing something, and it matters. And also, you know, the shit talking factor of like, God, you see what I did to you. But at the same time, I think that is still there on some level. As long as you update the presentation, there's at least a North American audience that does get something else from it. Now, I'm not sure what the age group is or what, but it's like it brings back for me like that Mortal Kombat thing where it was a talking point. About us at the time, I was like, what? I was in high school, you know, junior high. So.
Had you a depression?
I would laugh at it then. It was cheesy. Because most of us like Street Fighter more anyway. It didn't really, you know,
yeah, but
a little bit of blood.
Again, I think the gore in games, I have difficulty already for the amount of gore, to be honest, we have in Crysis.
What about TNA?
TNA?
Tit and ass. As the Americans say. No,
is that enough in there?
You see, we don't have shorts for
let's
that.
Let's say sexual content or innuendo. Not innuendo, just...
You see, this is
not
one,
that
one
any
thing
place
which
for
is interesting.
Game, but this just
interesting.
In general in games.
This is one thing
hot
interesting.
Hot coffee, you know.
Yeah, like sexual content in game versus gore in game. To be honest, I would rather have sexual content than gore. In the game,
this is the Europeans.
This is exactly
yeah.
Yeah.
This is
exactly. This, I was going to say this again. Where Europe differences with America. Mm-hmm. When we have visitors from US to come to Europe to visit mm-hmm. us effectively, when they go to the hotel rooms and they just watch TV like yeah. regular TV, they say, "Dude, you have porn in the TV." I said, "No, it's not porn. This is normal."
Yeah. My wife is French, and the first time I went over there and I was watching television with her and her parents, my in-laws, and we're watching the 6 o'clock news, and there's a soap commercial, and you know, on our soap commercials, it's all just innuendo and just like different camera angles, and there was just a nude lady using soap, and it was a commercial for soap,
and
I was just like, wow, this is the best commercial ever.
This is the best soap I've ever.
And you know, all the French people in the room were just like, what is your problem? Have you not seen a naked person?
I bet you went out to buy the
just
soap by the way, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And say, please,
but you hear that, you know, it's true. You hear that all the time. You know, what is the Americans hang up with?
Nudity. That's the thing. So like if we were to have sexual content, I think we would push that much more. Probably would get more trouble in US.
Yeah,
than the other way around. Yeah.
You would get your adults only rating if you had
a
naked breast.
The classic
in there.
Examples, you know, in the Grand Theft Auto series where they had what was called the hot coffee thing that that you can unlock in it. And I mean, you already had a game that consisted of it didn't require you to shoot cops,
but you see,
but
hot
it involved
coffee,
shooting cops.
But you see,
and
hot all, coffee
and shooting people and everything else. Yeah, but then you get a blowjob. You get your wing dang doodle
but you
going,
don't,
and bam, it's time to
it's
go to
criminal.
Court.
Yeah, but you see the hot coffee mod thing for GTA was no discussion in Germany.
It was a non-issue.
Yeah.
Well, but this proves you guys are more level-headed than us, I think.
I really think sexual content is always, you know, sexual content is not, it doesn't imply, I mean, the reason why I would prefer sexual content, and I'm saying if I would choose, and I want to be clear about this, I would rather choose sexual content versus gore, because for me it's less sick to showcase what happens all anyway with normal lives versus blowing off people. You know, that doesn't happen in reality.
But don't you think somebody could then say, okay, but you're, you know, you just devoted your time to making a game in which you're just shooting people. You know, somebody who's so you have a limit where, of how much gore you can deal with, and we all do too. But there's going to be other people, you know, older people or whatever, who are going to just look at any game where you're shooting someone and just say, that's sick.
No, it's because we don't glorify the shooting experience at the moment. And the way we do it is we just say it's an action of means. It's a means to survive. And it's a means to...
When the guy takes a piss on the dock and you shoot him in the back, you're glorifying it.
Well...
And that was definitely put in there to glorify.
But you don't have to just to make you laugh. It's not glorifying it.
No, glorifying would be if he pisses and they piss around and the piss itself.
spins around out of control. Yeah, yeah.
At E3, when I saw that behavior, the first thing was like, you pull up your pistol, you know, your customization, and you look if you have an electrical dart to shoot into the water.
Yeah.
I sadly didn't have one. You got to hook me up, man.
Yeah, but again, this is where, as I said, this is where it becomes interesting in terms of design, where you say, okay, we do shoot people, but you shoot not, you are not rewarded for shooting the people. You actually, you have objectives, what you have to do in the game, and the objectives say never kill everybody. You know, the objective is not about shooting people. It's about getting this the whole experience of the crisis, which is the finding the going through the storyline. I don't want to tell anything about story anymore. I want you to play the game. But principally, if you go into the game and your survival act starts where you get detected, essentially the pisser detected you, then the core gameplay is about shooting. And even if you survive that aspect, then we don't want to glorify that. But the surviving effect itself is already enough of a reward.
Speaking of spoilers, I think this says a lot about the nature of games and selling games. But I already know, not just because, you know, I write about and I visit your studio, but I already know in the world of enthusiasts, you know, that go to websites and read magazines, knows about the interior of the alien structure. They know about the icing and all this stuff. Now imagine, like, I always think back at the time, the first time I saw Alien, right? And no one told me about it. I don't know how. It's because I was young and I didn't have the chance to hear everyone spoil the chest bursting scene and everything.
This was pre-internet too,
right?
Though.
And when you go into it at the time, you're like, I always wonder, would it have blew my mind in the same way if everyone had warned me about it? But I mean, is it in games, even the most carefully guarded, you know, games where they're most carefully guarded, and traditionally they're the ones that have already proven themselves because they don't need to reveal they don't need to strip down
Crysis
naked
had
to get everyone interested.
Yeah, Crysis had to go through this process of revelation here and there simply because the hype asked for it and development times were long. And so this was a kind of like a market demand effectively. But at the same time, I would say Crysis 2, if it would have happened, you wouldn't see anything from Crysis for a long, long time. In fact, I wish, to be honest, that I could say to you today, look, I have a cool game to show. It's called Crysis. First time ever. I would bet your impression would be tenfold higher today than it is.
You're right.
What if this game just came out and then all of a sudden it just hit and then... Next thing I know, I mean, just out of the blue, you know, in a month from now, I'm playing Crysis.
Imagine you just get a DVD sent in as a review and say, here, please review.
And you put that in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, then that will be a complete different experience for you and probably will be the way we'll handle in future our developments.
Your publishers aren't going to be happy with that.
They will be. they will be because we will make sure that we talk about it in different ways without revealing. The visuals.
Without talking about the specifics.
Yeah, particularly one thing we will avoid for sure is...
You like how we already got you to admit the sequel?
Yeah, yeah, that I hate it already.
We're still waiting for the console.
You see? Yeah, yeah. Confirmation. Yeah, yeah, I will confirm. Just get me drunk and I'll confirm. No, but the way games are marketed, I wish the developers could release the games without relying on the marketing or the hype surrounding it. But it takes a lot of efforts and time to make people aware of anything today because of the internet. The market is convoluted with many, many hundreds of games. And to constantly remember and stand out and to be there, I would argue today there are games which are completely overlooked still, completely. And if you look at Crysis, it has been constantly in the top most wanted, but we had to stay there. You know, mm-hmm. So we had to create that hype, and we can't show all the time same content. At the same time, it's sad because, of course, it has an impact on the first experience. So the people who never saw of Crysis and they get it first time, we had those people in the focus group tests. People which we said, did you play shooters? He said, yes. Did you ever have a Crysis? No. And we had them test Crysis, and they were a completely different experience than people who actually knew everything about Crysis and they play tested. That person who never played, he was... literally said he was shocked, you know, he was completely shocked by the experience. Whereas the other guy, the other gamer was like, damn, it's just plays like I saw the, I can't believe I'm playing the great looking game now myself, you know. So it was linking.
In this industry, we write different stories every month to the point where we're now talking about the specific builds that we're playing, yeah, along every step of the
as
way.
As I said, you know,
in the mass market, I mean, maybe there are, maybe that those players are still there, but it's like, it's weird because, I mean, among the enthusiasts, it's like they have the blueprints to your house. And not only that, like if you're making a house for someone, they're there every step of the way, watching it, commenting every time, you know, one of the guys with whatever it is, the trowel fucks up and puts a cigarette butt in the, you know, inside the border.
I believe also, by the way, the movie industry is going to get to that point too. Very soon as well, to catch, because it's the only way entertainment can survive. The customers are close to the entertainment. They're more part of development, or they follow development more. In the games, it's inherently the case because the games industry takes 2 to 3 years to develop games.
And it takes a lot of money, too.
Yeah.
And you need to recover.
And also, it's a matter of risk management, in effect. Because, like, in a year, when you show the concept reveal and the people's like, what the fuck is that? You say, oh, we better stop developing the game because it ain't going to sell. So it's, I mean, you don't test it usually by PR, but you test it usually by focus groups before that anyway. But some companies may use it as a gauge of, hey, maybe should we change our designs? Maybe we should make another game. Or maybe we should emphasize this aspect, which people liked really. And this didn't, we should maybe redesign the game completely. So it gives opportunities to react on the feedback on a bigger scale rather than only small tests. Like shows, for example, like E3, for us, was a great way to see how are the people now in a much bigger scale reacting to this. Mm. Where they see the first time and can handle.
How did they react at E3?
They were amazingly positive. And
But you didn't get the graphics award, the beauty show prize.
No, I mean the year before.
Okay. So what about this year though?
Like this year, well,
how
this
did
year,
that feel?
You know,
when,
I didn't
when
even
Call
go
Duty
to
four got the. Got the
well, I was
prize.
Disappointed to be honest, not for myself, but for the team because they really put a lot of efforts and blood and sweat and tears into it. Mm-hmm. And
do you think that your game was the best looking for graphics again? This is
I don't understand why. I mean, you can argue today anybody who understands graphics, real time graphics,
right?
He needs to be blind to understand that it's not the best looking graphic game right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think again that might be what you're talking about the expectations and people having seen it already.
Yeah, Call of Duty was out of nowhere.
And people were like, oh yeah, Crysis, it still looks great.
And then Call of Duty's out like this season too, which is, you know, it's totally.
So Call of Duty, for example, was a strong way of market and PR reveal. It was very well done, mm-hmm. timed very well, and. I mean, it looks great, mm-hmm. but it's not the best looking game. I would argue it doesn't even look as good as Gears of War, in my opinion, for example.
There we go. That's,
all right.
That's the hot quote.
No, uh-huh. That's the one they're all going to be quoting.
I think that's a good point, you know, because when I looked at it at the time, I was willing to call like PC bias or just because so many of the people on and again, when the award, we're talking about specific people like Jeff Green, and most of them. I mean, I'm guessing aren't avid PC gamers.
I didn't vote.
So my guess, my suspicion was that that was going to be part of the thing. But again, I think it's what you're saying. I mean, the recent debut of Call of Duty, I think, had something to do with it. Because if you had unveiled Crysis at this E3, I'm pretty sure that it would have.
Yeah, I believe that Call of Duty 4 probably won just because it was a surprise. Mm-hmm.
But again,
just like you're talking about with seeing Alien for the first time.
As I said, what we did is we had just one thing, for example, when we released the first tech trailer ever, we had from 1 million Google hits, 12 million within a week. Mm-hmm. Now we are constantly at about 15 to 25 million hits, somewhere between that we range all the time, which is great. But the jump we had for the first reveal, never had again.
Right.
Natural. Okay. It's completely understandable and relatable. Even not with revealing the first DXTEN trailer, even that didn't make a spark. Mm-hmm. EA didn't, like E3 didn't make sparks. The different EA events we had.
Right. See, to me, the biggest surprise of the Microsoft event, that first night that they had in that big open thing, the big surprise to me there was in all their spiel about all their games, they showed Crysis for like
a quick second.
Five seconds or something.
They showed that cartoony Spider-Man.
And they had that gigantic screen, and I thought, why are you not showing off the best-looking PC game on this huge screen for all these people, a great portion of them who don't play PC games, for them to see? And my feeling was, oh, well, they felt like Crysis, you know, we've been showing it for forever already, so.
Yeah, that's the problem of it, for sure. And again, for me, it's really about making small splashes versus making a big wave, you know. The making one wave that overtakes, like it's a big wave rather than little splashes of drops.
Specifically, so we won't drop anymore. The judges' awards are meaningless. I mean, I can't imagine for you, other than for internal morale, that you guys would think too much of. What does it really amount to, you know?
Well, the one award which was for us motivation. I mean, the awards are only motivation. It's recognition. It's an achievement. I always say it's not about our experience. It's about what we achieve as a studio is what matters. This is what I tell to the team. Nobody will care how much experience you have. Everybody will care what did you achieve in your life. And so the Critic Awards is an achievement for a studio. And people can say, look, I like when we won the Best PC Game Award, effectively, that was for us an achievement. But and what caused it? It caused a huge motivation for the final phase of the development. Mm-hmm. That recognition only caused that. Nothing else, no consequences on the economics or design or what's not. Just motivation. Mm-hmm. Which was already a long development cycle, and to make that somehow, like, because it's really last, it's a pain for the developers to work on a project that long.
And take that long to get feedback to get the justification of, you know.
Yeah.
Here's a question that's going to seem like it comes out of nowhere. How much time would you expect someone to have to spend with Power Struggle, for example, before that they were able to provide a reliable critique of it?
I think already in the first 50 minutes where they say to me they didn't get that. And then probably after 2 hours at a phase where they got rules and they play everything, but they may give feedback on the UI. And then probably 4 to 5 hours to get a good sense of it. But to get really deep, you have to play it for probably 2-3 weeks to get really deep into everything. So to be mastering and to find tactics, like what we did is we observed the beta forums also in terms of what kind of tactics people develop. Mm-hmm. And they came up with tactics really, which we said, wow, that's really smart, you know. Like even our QA testers who play the game in and out, they didn't come up with those ideas.
Can you give any examples of those?
Yeah, for example, what happened in, they spawn, like in one of the beta tests, before the beta test, during our QA, we had something called an experts group, okay? So before we even started beta, before we had something called family and friends test. Before the family and friends test, we had a test called the experts club. The experts club effectively were gamers, which pro gamers and hardcore gamers, they play multiplayer. They were invited for 2 months every week to play against our QA. the mode. And after 3 weeks for playing effectively 3 hours, what they did is when they went back, because they were like clans, they went back, they started thinking about what should we do. And they formed a tactic which is resolved around a spawn track. So they had people who guarded it effectively, and they moved this as a spawning base closer and closer, like a Roman legion empire, you know. They made attack, moved closer, attack, moved closer, attack, moved closer. And our guys didn't know what to do with it, how to deal with it.
They couldn't take it out with, none of them were making enough money to get, like, a powerful tank or anything?
Well, they were all killing, you know, and they moved there.
Because so they would have tanks and everything with it in a giant column?
Yeah, they were literally like a legion moving forward.
Okay.
And
is that where the tactical nuke came from?
Yeah, we had some countermeasures and developed for that.
Okay.
But the principal idea is that people emerge with tactics of formations and groups, because the units are physicalized and everything. They take, like, if you take a physical space of tanks, you can't go through this road, right? You have to bypass the pass. So they blocked passes and things like this.
Bridges.
And and that's where it becomes really tactical, when people emerge in techniques or tactics. And seeing this happen in Power Struggle for all the various maps, I think will take a lot of time. And as a critique, you will probably having a good idea of it, the potential of it. Because I always say a good idea, I was saying to Andrew about this, a good idea is always a good idea if it inspires you. So after you play, you think about what I could do.
Yeah.
And so if it gets you thinking, then I think it means that you could play this for the next weeks and you always get new ideas. And this is a top of naturally inherent their gameplay, Power Struggle itself, inherent their gameplay that inspires you for new tactics all the time.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. It's hardcore multiplayer. I mean, like, the very best games are the ones that when you go to bed, that's where I'm at with Team Fortress 2 right now. You know, you turn the game off and you're like, what if I try this and I do this or that other thing, you know, and then you go back and you test it and experiment, and, you know, sometimes it pays off, other times.
As long as you don't dream from it.
yeah. Okay, so we're getting the wrap-up call.
We're getting the wrap-up sign here.
Oh, it was so fun.
Well, yeah, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you.
And we out. We out. We out. We out.